Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. Representative Haas, we don't have a quorum yet, so we won't move your bill, but we'll hear your bill, and when we have a quorum, we will move it, as well as you have an amendment also. Why don't you at least tell us what the amendment does?
Thank you. House File 161, and it was, the amendment was to improve the process of if a person was found innocent of the crime, and make it more convenient for them to have their money returned. Prior to this time, the law said all they had to do was request it. This gives a process for returning that money. Probably the next step up would be you would make the responsibility of the county or the sheriff's department to track and return that. And those three, requesting and what we have here in the bill, in the process of getting information and an envelope to request that, are okay with us. The other is a little bulky, and we would have some concern with that. But that's the basic difference. From the original law, which was put in, I believe, in 1997, allowed $10 to be collected from the booking fee if, in fact, you were going to be jailed. It did not allow that if you were jailed and released. We're going to find today some really interesting things for those that are lawyers. They do depositions, so they really find facts. I found out some real interesting facts about these things, and they'll be highlighted for us. And it's a good education process both for you and for me. In the area that I come from, Stearns County is a city within three counties. So we have St. Cloud, Sherburne, St. Cloud, Benton, and St. Cloud, Stearns. And the jail is found in Stearns. So to save people time, many of those bookings come directly from St. Cloud, Sherburne to Stearns, from St. Cloud, Benton to Stearns. We also have many young people and a college in our town. So to have a Friday night special event where you book hundreds or 50 or 100 people is not an unusual activity. And that probably means that you have to empty your jails, and so to get ready for that preparation. So in different areas, you find different things. I asked Mr. Sanner to try to calculate for me, of the 8,000 people that are booked, how many eventually would be found innocent of the charge. And their calculation was 1%. You're going to hear testimony from Hennepin County of a very higher rate, and I guess if I was looking at that high rate in Stearns County, I probably would have not brought the bill forward. I would feel a lot different about it if that was it. So as we analyze this, maybe we have to have a study of how many people are actually being booked that are not found guilty of crimes, and why would one area be at 1% and one area be at a higher percent, or a significantly higher percent. I do have a witness with me today, and I'm very happy for him to come down. This is the sheriff of Stearns County, John Sanner, and we worked on a lot of these problems together in order to make budgets balance. And jails work when you have double bunked already and you have lots of problems. So these are techniques. The concern here to me is we're kind of trying to make budgets balance, and that is a major concern, and some type of light user fees and as much strategy as possible has to be, because when I was putting budgets together for the county, the total budget with all the money coming in from the state and the federal, whatever, that $100 million budget that we work with, that would go up 1.5%, 1.9%. But the county share, which had to be dispersed to the taxpayer, would go up at 10% and 11%, just to meet the shifts and the mandates that were being passed down. when you look at this in Minneapolis, maybe you look at it at $10. When you look at it at Minneapolis and Hennepin County itself, Minneapolis pays $75 per booking to Hennepin County, which is $2.5 million. So in a budget, you may think of it as 10, but in that Minneapolis area, you would think of it as 2.5. By the way, at one time, in the early versions, the chief of police of Minneapolis, Timothy J. Dolan, endorsed this. At one time, in the early versions, the sheriff's association endorsed it, and the county associations endorsed that. And with that, I'm going to let my witness testify.
Sheriff, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you very much for allowing me this opportunity. My name is John Sander. I'm the sheriff in Stearns County. And it sounds like, in listening to Representative Haas briefly describe this, I'm going to be echoing some of that in my testimony with some of the information that I will try to provide for you this morning. I can give you some hard Stearns County numbers, and I can give you some estimates based on our experiences. In 2006, Stearns County Jail booked almost 8,000 inmates, 7,940. Out of that, 2,328 inmates were booked and released. Conservatively, we estimate the booking process is costing the county taxpayer between $25 and $75 per inmate when we look at all the costs involved. What we would like to see happen is we would like to shift the burden from the property taxpayer in the county to the offender, at least a portion of that, so they're responsible for some of their own actions financially. I know the biggest heartburn here is, how do we assess a fee to somebody that is eventually found not guilty? How do we assess a fee to an innocent person? So I asked the jail administrator, how many people in 2006 did we book that eventually were found not guilty? And he said, we would have to go through all 8,000 of those and track them through several different jurisdictions. It would be a tremendous a job to try to track every one of those down. So I said, could you please just give me an estimate on approximately how many people are found not guilty that we book into our jail? He said, the percentage is very small. I said, could you estimate for me? Is it 30%? Is it 20%? He said, Sheriff, he said, it's 1% or less that are eventually found not guilty. He said, all of the rest are found guilty of something. It might be a reduced charge, but they're found guilty of something. So what we're dealing with here is, over, at least in Stearns County, over 99% of our bookings are found guilty. So that relieved some of the heartburn for me. We understand that increasing the booking fee some and then allowing us to charge a fee to the inmates that are booked and released is not a complete fix for the county. Some of the burden will still stay with the county taxpayer, but at least it's a step in the right direction, we believe. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff, for your testimony. Is there, do you have any other witnesses?
No, but there's some people that would like to testify on the other side of this issue, and I would like to make that time available.
If there's someone who wants to testify on this bill, would you come forward? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lenny Castro. I'm the Chief Public Defender of Hennepin County.
Welcome, Mr. Castro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm speaking to you today against this bill for several reasons. First, I would say that the point that the representative made regarding a taking from someone that has not been convicted of any crime is clearly inappropriate in any setting. We are a nation of laws, and we shouldn't be taking money, property, or liberty from people without them having done something wrong, and particularly when it comes to the money in their pockets, from a taking without a conviction. There is, to my knowledge, no other fee assessed to a person who is charged with a crime until they are convicted of a crime. I certainly understand the municipality and local government budgetary concerns, but we can't fix those issues on the backs of people that have not been convicted of anything. As it relates to the number of people who are not convicted, Hennepin County probably has over 20,000 people in a year who are booked, either released, the case dismissed, the case continued for dismissal, or never charged. And the bill, as it currently stands, has a mechanism to return the money, but I think the Sheriff's Association will tell you that that money is not returned at this point. So as it sits right now, the safeguard that was there before has not taken effect. And there's a lot of good reasons for that. I mean, you're putting a tremendous administrative strain on the Sheriff's Department to track everybody who goes through the system and to make a determination as to whether or not they've been convicted or not. What I am asking this body to do is to adopt the companion bill, which is Senate File 323, which essentially increases the fee to $45, but it does not impose the fee until a person is convicted, like every other fee that a convicted person is, that the court imposes on an individual. And then the court essentially collects that fee and transfers that money to the appropriate agency. There also is the provision in both bills, which I in the House bill and in the Senate bill, which allows for a waiver of that fee, of course, if the person is indigent. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions of Mr. Castro? Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, we take stuff from people all the time as evidence, naturally. Cars, trucks, property is the hang-up that you're worried about not getting it back. In other words, I mean, I used to take cars, money, drugs, guns, all sorts of things. And if the conviction was overturned or they were acquitted, we'd give it back. Why not just, while we got them in hand, grab the money and give it back? I mean, what's the problem? What's the difference here? Is it to you, is it a fine or bail, or how do you consider it? Why not take the money while you got them?
Mr. Castro.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there's a significant difference in my mind. I mean, we've established a set of rules and procedures that, of course, law enforcement needs in order to effectuate due process, in order to give both the government and the individual a fair trial. That requires the government in order to hold on to certain property that may be needed and used in evidence. This money is not that sort of issue. I mean, this money essentially is a taking without any due process.
Representative Cornish.
No, that's good.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Castro. This is not so much a question, it's just a comment. I'm really glad to hear, I'm glad you came today to articulate these concerns, because I really share a lot of your concerns, and you've articulated them much better than I could, because I really feel like there's something really unseemly about doing this. And if it's not outright unconstitutional, it certainly violates our sense of fairness. What we've got here is a procedure where the police pick somebody up. We know that the ultimate check on that comes in the court, but here we've got a procedure where we allow that person essentially to be fined. And if we extended this, we could, why not just make them pay the fine for the offense? And then if they're found not guilty, we'll give it back to them later. I mean, it's just, I think, really crosses the line, and I just wanted to tell you that I appreciated your comments.
Representative Dominguez, and then I don't know who was first.
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Castro, could you tell us how much this affects the folks that are low income or poor folks that are being arrested, and those fines or those fees, how does that affect them?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dominguez, this, of course, disproportionately impacts the poor, particularly my clients, who walk into a jail or get picked up by the police, walk into a jail, and whatever money they have on their person may be the only money they have for the week, whether it's the bus money to get to work the next day, whether it's the money for lunch, the last $25 that they might have significantly impacts poor people much more than it does the wealthy. Now, I will also say that there is a significant difference when this is being effectuated in a metro, in an urban area, and the activities that go on in an urban area are very different than those that go on in rural area. I don't know what the numbers are in Stearns County, although we can pretty much call that an urban area these days. But I don't know about the numbers of folks who actually get convicted, but I can tell you that there's probably a lot of folks that get booked and released. And if this money is being collected from those individuals and there is no effective mechanism to return it to them, ultimately that seems to be extremely unfair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was hoping that we could maybe hear from the author as to why he was not in favor of the Senate version of the bill, and it would be nice if there was someone from another county who can talk, maybe from Hennepin, about how much money they currently collect, how it's currently working. I think I voted in favor of allowing them to do that previously, and so I'd like to hear what the real problems have been before I vote to not do it anymore.
Well, can you hold off just and let's have the questions for Mr. Castro first, and then we can... Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Castro, I've got more of a comment than a question. Evidently, according to your testimony, things function a little different in urban society than they do in rural Minnesota, because I know for a fact the Pennington County Sheriff's Office isn't going to collect money from indigent people in the first place. We haven't, we won't, we never have, we never will. So evidently, the accusations I take objection to if you're saying that this system would not work in Pennington County, because this system will work in Pennington County.
If I can respond to that, Mr.
Castro.
Mr. Chair and Representative, whether it works in one county or another, what this body is intending to do is pass a state mandate on this issue. And I spent 7.5 years as Chief Public Defender of Southwest Minnesota in Rock County, in Murray County, in Pipestone County, and Lincoln County, one of the smallest counties in this state. And I am very familiar with the practices. I am very familiar that a lot less people get booked in those jurisdictions. And there is poverty in those jurisdictions as well. I don't know what the practices are in all 87 counties, but what I can say is that when you implement something like this, you may have somebody at guard now who will not take money from indigent people, but that's not what this law allows. And what we tried to do is prevent this from happening not only next week, but 10 years from now.
Senator Olin, you have a follow-up
question? I have a follow-up comment. I have spent considerable time sitting in the committee the last 2 months listening to several things that everybody says are only good for Minneapolis or St. Paul, and I will vote for some of those things. So I take a little objection to when it comes to an issue that the counties aren't exactly all in united, that they come in and say it's a statewide, but when I listen to a program request for Minneapolis money, it's Minneapolis money. It either is or it isn't. It's either a statewide project or it's statewide money.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Castro, my first reaction is boo-hoo, cry me a river for the poor people. I mean, most of the people that come in that door are guilty. 98% conviction rate, and the 2% that get off are most of the times on a technicality or a 36-hour rule is expired or something else has gone wrong. And poor folks shouldn't be getting their butt in trouble. And once they do, they should pay like anybody else. I was a poor folk. I grew up in poverty myself. I didn't turn to crime and expect somebody else to pay for it. So I'm not shedding any tears for these people that walk into jail and don't expect to pay anything, even if it's their last $10. They shouldn't have got themselves in trouble.
Did you want to respond to that, Mr.
Mr. Chair and Representative Furness, I'm with you. I grew up in the inner city of New York and Chicago, and I have never been booked. So I don't know what that experience is like. But I will say to you that your numbers are wrong. It is not 2% of the people. We have, as it relates to the number of folks that get released, dismissed, or continued for dismissal, is in excess of 50% in Minneapolis.
The point is, they did something wrong to get there. And those dismissals doesn't mean that they weren't guilty. Those dismissals mean that maybe somebody screwed up. But that person to get into jail either hit a curb or busted somebody's window or did something and got off on some other thing that happened along the way. And there's got to be a way we can weed out the very few people that aren't guilty. Over a 20-year career that we had in DNR enforcement, we wrote tickets, we had a 98% conviction rate of the tickets we wrote. So I know it's high, the conviction rate. But there's got to be some way we can separate out the true not guilty people where maybe somebody got jerked off the street for no reason at all. I can't believe that it happens nowadays. But there's got to be some mechanism where we can pass this bill and get more money for the counties without worrying too much about these.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Cornish, there is a way. It's called the rule of law, and it is giving people due process, an opportunity to be heard, and letting the justice system follow the process.
We have Representative Lesh, Liebling, Smith, and then we're going to go back to Representative Hillstrom's question, and then I would like to move on if we could. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Castro, I don't have separate numbers for Hennepin County, so can you tell me what percentage of criminal files in Hennepin County qualify for a public defender?
Mr. Castro.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I can give you some ballpark figures as it relates to the number of folks that we represent. My office represents about 6,000 people in felony cases on an annual basis. That's approximately 92-93% of the felony cases, and my office represents anywhere from 22,000 to 25,000 people in misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor cases. That's approximately 35-40% of the cases that come through the system.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm guessing I'm not that good at math. If I could have done math, I would have gone to medical school, not law school. But I'm guessing that somewhere around 50% or maybe a little bit over. Can you estimate, after, say, a comprehensive audit of those cases, how many actually would still qualify for a public defender if it was determined their true assets and everything else?
Mr. Castro.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I can give you an estimate to that. The court makes an inquiry into the financial ability to pay, and they make a determination whether or not they're eligible for our services. But what I can say is that, of course, the majority of those folks aren't booked. The majority of those folks come through summons or come through some citation, and they're not actually booked in the county jail.
Okay. Well, just a last comment, Mr. Chair. You know, I understand that, but I appreciate the opportunity to have public defenders in here. But I see many cases in Ramsey County where individuals come in, and it's a high percentage, just like Hennepin County, where we're talking about indigent individuals who are unable to pay whatever fee we have, and we equate that oftentimes with who qualifies for a public defender, and all too often I see folks who are taking resources from the public defenders who otherwise shouldn't be. You got high caseloads in Hennepin, just like they do over in Ramsey, and I think that should be a concern that we're looking at here.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think a lot of our discussion here, well, to me anyway, is kind of beside the point, because it really doesn't matter if it's one person out of 100,000 who ultimately is not guilty. I mean, there's a procedural problem here that I think violates, I think it's a violation of due process. And I just wanted to respond briefly to Representative Cornish, because under his formulation, we could sure save a lot of money in the courts. I mean, we're struggling with a big budget here. The courts need more judges. We need more appellate judges. Boy, if everybody, we could just assume they're all guilty, we could just do away with a lot of that, you know, and just go straight from booking to jail. So.
So
no. Well, at least we got that out in the open. Now we know what we're dealing with here. So. Anyway, I just think that, to Representative Owen, I don't think the issue here is really what one county can get for money and what another county can get for money. I mean, I think it really has to do with just that it is not the right way to do this. I mean, I am perfectly sympathetic to the counties and their need to have funding and the need to have fair funding across the state and all of that, but I just don't think this is the way to do it.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I had two questions, but I asked the author. The motion is, ultimately the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. So I trust the chair can control the length at which we're going to hear more of this testimony. I perhaps shouldn't even ask to speak. However, a question and then a comment, Mr. Castro, if the, under this bill or the author, if the charged person doesn't have the $25, can they just go home?
Mr. Castro.
I move the amendment, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, no, they just can't go home. You know, unlike most fees that we charge folks, user fees, this is an involuntary user fee. What ends up happening if someone is booked and, say, for instance, a family member delivers money to the jail for, let's say, you know, to the commissary, let's say, for a snack or for cigarettes or for whatever vice that someone may have, whether it's cigarettes or chocolate, that money is taken from the individual if that $25 hasn't been paid, and if it still hasn't been paid, then the court is mandated to impose that fee if they are convicted. So I guess you have an imbalance here. If you don't have it on you and you get released, you don't have to pay it. If you have it on you and you get released, you have to pay it. So we got quite a disparate treatment.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just a thought. It's a good thing this will be laid over. I think, like most arguments, there's two sides to every coin. There are some positives and some negatives. I guess the notion of charging a fee to an indigent, you know, albeit someone charged with a crime, is offensive. And I hear your testimony and I agree with it. Yet what better way to start hitting someone with the gravity of what situation they're in by starting to hit them in the wallet? I mean, that's what we do with people who get speeding tickets and so forth. You know, you can't get into a park unless you pay the state park, unless you pay the park fee. So I'm not totally adverse to the notion of charging a person with a criminal crime, with a crime, some to get into jail. On the other hand, I think society, if they buy your argument, and it may very well, Mr. Castro, I think society is willing to pay what it costs to maintain its security through our judicial system. So I think the bill has merits. How much merit is the question? You can help us find, Mr. Chairman, later on.
Okay, now, Representative Olin, did you have a quick comment?
No, I'll let it go.
Representative Murphy, did you have a quick comment?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman. Once again, it's a speech that I give about once a year. Once again, it's not the person that's done the wrong that ends up paying. It's the children of the person or the wife of the person. Mr. Chairman, we need more money in community corrections. and we need more money in, that's funneled out to the counties for their public safety. But this isn't making much impact on the individual that's done wrong or hasn't done wrong, but is being questioned about doing wrong and brought to the jail. It ultimately goes back to everybody else in the family or that person's related to pays. And the impact isn't on that individual. I think we should put more money in community corrections.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. At this point, we have a quorum, Representative Haas. So I'd like you to move your bill.
I would
bill
move
and
my bill for possible inclusion. That's a new category. I would like to point out a few things, though, Mr. Chair.
Representative Haas, before you do that, let's get the bill the way you want it. And so would you move the...
Oh, I would move the delete and delete all. I would move the DDL and insert amendment, and that is 323A2.
It's the DE1 amendment, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any discussion on the DE1 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Haas, now we have your bill. And you have a question from Representative Hillstrom. Representative Hillstrom, do you want to ask it again?
I'm just curious as to why he doesn't have the Senate language here, if he likes that better or doesn't.
Well,
and then
in the original amendments, we had unison from the counties and the Sheriff's Association and myself and my county. With the Senate amendment, you have none of those, including mine, because you're moving it up. It's probably not, you're going to have somebody pay a whole bunch, and not very many people pay it. So if that's where it was going, I would just soon pull it and throw it away. Now I would like to tell you why I'm not a big, mean man. And I have pretty good proof.
Okay, briefly, Representative.
I will briefly. What I need to do. There is a similar law in the state of Minnesota that collects $10. That law is Statute 206-64.12. Which is already doing this at $10, which you passed, which we passed. How did this get better for the person without money? How did it get better? One, I put in law what is happening, asked to put in law what's happening, is that the sheriff has the right to waive the fee if in fact he thinks it's a burden. That's not in the other law. That's a plus. The other law that's in effect now says they have to request it. This law improves it and says they will be given a form, an envelope, and a stamp to get it back. Before, people could charge people if they didn't have money when they got to the court. This bill improves that. It improves it by saying unless the person qualifies financially for a public defender, there is three solid cases where innocent people and poor people are being defended by this bill in an improvement to a law that's already in the state of Minnesota. And that's, I'll take a two possible inclusion with that argument. Thank you, sir.
Okay, is there any other... Are there any other questions, discussion? Thank you, Mr. Castro. Thank you, Sheriff, for your testimony. Is anyone else who wishes to testify on behalf of this bill? Then, seeing none, we will lay House File 161 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senator Ola.
While Representative Paymar is getting organized, would somebody like to move the minutes for February 20th, March 1st, and March 7th? Motion by Zellers. All those, in, any corrections, additions, anybody saw? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Representative Paymar.
Chair, I like to move House File 545, and I have amendments, the A1 amendment that would, on page 1, would delete lines 12.
Through
14.
You've heard Representative Paymar's motion today to amend his. Are there any objections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? You may proceed, Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill would provide $200,000 to the Board of Public Defense to pay court reporters for production of transcripts to appellate cases and post-conviction remedy cases. This has been a long-going problem that this committee has had to deal with. This may be a moot bill because the appropriation actually is in the governor's deficiency bill, but we have not acted on that bill as of yet. I have with me Kevin Kyer, Board of Public Defense. I'll let him outline what the problem is and answer questions for you.
Mr. Kyer, will you proceed?
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. Representative Paymar kind of laid out the issue, and I think we laid it out when we were here for our budget hearing last month. The board last year expended $821,000 on trial transcripts for the appellate office. We have a budget of $300,000. In the last several years, we've exceeded budget, and what we tend to do is hold on to those bills, wait to pay them out of the next fiscal year, which Senator Boland's shaking his head, and he has some experience with that, I think, at county government, and it finally has caught up with us. And what ends up happening is that we have to wait several months to pay the court reporters who have a mandatory time frame in which to produce the transcripts because we have a timeline in which we have to file our cases with the Court of Appeal, with the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. And so what we end up with is a situation of more of a budget problem for us and obviously a huge problem for those court reporters who this year were stopped payment to I guess 60 days ago, something like that. So last year was about 4 or 5 months that they had to wait to get paid. This year probably be about 6 months or 7 months. And so that's really the issue in a nutshell.
Are there any questions or represent Mr. Kyer?
Maybe for the chair or for Representative Paymar. Representative Paymar, what is the motion here? Is it going to be to lay this over? I know we've got a deficiency bill and this is in there. I support getting. I think there's some issues related to transcripts that are bigger than this. But clearly, these individuals have prepared transcripts and they're expecting to be paid. They ought to be paid. So I'm hoping the deficiency bill moves through. But are we going to lay this over for possible inclusion? Are we going to send this through separately and have a little $200,000 deficiency bill in case the other one gets clogged up? I mean, I want to see the court reporters get paid for what they've done. And so I have that concern, but how are we going to proceed here?
Sure, it was my intent to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and assuming that the deficiency bill passes, is it the Finance or Ways and Means Monday, I suspect that this will be moot. And if there's a problem with it in Ways and Means, then we will consider this for the omnibus bill. I think we have to deal with this problem.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would just note, I have no idea what's going to happen with the deficiency bill. I'm guessing it's going to pass, but I don't know. I hope, Representative Paymar, you'd give some consideration if that gets bollocked up to maybe moving this thing through on its own, if we could do it quickly and get these people paid. I don't have a problem with the bill. I think it only makes sense, and this is one that seems fairly non-controversial.
Mr. Chair, we also have
Representative Lee's got a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe it would be more, I don't know who the next testifier is, but I just wanted to raise the issue
and maybe this isn't exactly the right place, but just who monitors whether the charges for the transcripts are appropriate? And I recognize that the Public Defender's Office doesn't have any control over these costs, but I just wonder if you have any information about who does, or who's monitoring this to make sure that you know, that we're being charged only for hours that are actually put in and so on.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leva, what we do is when the appellate person, when they come in for an appeal or post-conviction remedy, we send out a notice to the court reporter who was at that trial for an estimate of the number of pages that the transcript is going to be. They send that back. That's the notice that then generates them to start that work. When that transcript comes in, the lawyer who gets that transcript then signs off to say, yes, they actually received the transcript and that it's okay to pay. The fee is set by the judicial counsel, and so it's standard across the state. So if we get a transcript for 1,000 pages, we know exactly what it's supposed to cost.
Yes, Representative Lieberman.
Thank you. Well, just briefly, so these transcripts are done completely outside of the court reporter's normal job. There would be no overlap between their normal working hours and the time they spend working on these transcripts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I know we have some court reporters here, and I think they would probably better to address that than
I. I believe we have two witnesses coming from the court reporters, so I believe they all can answer better. Thank you, Mr. King. You state your name. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Sparks. I work as a court reporter in Hennepin County District Court, and I serve as union steward on behalf of the court reporters who are members of Teamsters Local 320, the public employee division of Teamsters representing over 11,000 members statewide. I have brief testimony. Court reporters statewide have been making good faith efforts to work with the Public Defender's Office in preparing appeal transcripts, despite a lack of funding available to pay for them. There is a growing sense of concern and frustration among my colleagues, though. We respect the defendant's right to appeal. However, we do not believe we should have to bear the financial responsibility for his or her exercising that right. Yet this is the situation we are facing. We have performed hours and hours of statutorily mandated work on our own time, for which thousands of dollars remain unpaid. We can neither afford nor should we be asked to underwrite the Board of Public Defense in this manner. Court reporters do not use state equipment in performing this part-time work. Utilizing a system proven to be the most effective, cost-effective, and accurate, we incur out-of-pocket expenses up front. The purchase and maintenance of computers and software, printers, toner, paper, covers, envelopes, postage, even contracting proofreaders. Transcript preparation is not optional. If you asked a science teacher to coach the high school football team evenings and weekends from August through November, then told him he'd get paid for his services and out-of-pocket expenses the following academic year, I venture to guess he'd turn down that job. We can't refuse this work. The court will impose sanctions against us if we fail to file transcripts. As Kevin Kyer stated, this is not the first time we have been in this situation. Last year, funds ran out in March, and this fiscal year we received notice in October that transcript funds were depleted. Court reporters cannot be expected to work without guaranteed timely payment. I urge the committee to support the public defender's request for an emergency appropriation. Thank you.
Representative Wing, did you want to answer your question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that. That helps. But my understanding then from what you said, that this transcript preparation is done entirely outside of the court reporter's normal working hours, that there's no overlap. I mean, they would not be doing any of this on time that's already being paid for.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can represent to you that in the 4th Judicial District is a very busy court. I work for the criminal presiding judge in criminal court, and when Judge Daly is on judicial business or on vacation, I'm answerable to the scheduling department. We have a difficulty covering all the courts, and so I'm oftentimes pulled to go work in another court to cover another judge or a magistrate's hearing. We're extremely busy, and this work is prepared on our own time. It is a part-time job. And I think there's another court reporter here who is prepared.
So you state your name and proceed.
My name is Jill Garrison. I'm a court reporter in Ramsey County here, 2nd Judicial District. And I am here in support of this bill and the providing appropriate funding for the transcripts that are requested and that we're required to produce. And I can answer the question with regard to, I think there was a question about the fees and the hours. We aren't paid an hourly fee, we're paid a per page fee. And so that is what is sent back to the state public, the public defender that requests a transcript. We fill out a little form stating approximately how many pages the transcript will be. Judicial counsel sets that page rate, and then that's how it's verified that as far as the pay goes, the number of pages that are produced, that's what the bill is that's sent to the public defender's office. I had a couple of large appeals this past year, a couple of high-profile murder cases, and I filed for an extension with the Supreme Court, and part of the reason, a big part of the reason that I did that was to raise this issue so that it would draw attention to the fact that there are many court reporters across the state that are sitting with, having spent a lot of time outside of their regular daily hours, and that are sitting with these unpaid bills. There are expenses that are incurred with regard to ordering enough paper. I had 9,000 pages I had to put out, and it's 9,000 times four because there's an original and three copies. And so I had to order a lot of paper, and that's something that I pay for out of my pocket. Toner for my printer. There's just a number of different expenses. I don't have it itemized in front of me, but that sits unpaid, or I pay it and wait 9 months for the check. And there are a number of reporters across the state that are expressing a great deal of frustration with that. So I raised the issue, not that I want to fight with the public defender's office, but I just wanted to bring it up and kind of throw the red flag up. I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone has.
Representative Rush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was talking a little bit, sorry, so I didn't hear all the testimony, but I don't think I specifically heard an answer to Representative Liebling's question. That can you assure the committee that all of these are done outside of regular work time?
That's
Garrison.
That generally is what happens. We are in court during the day. Now, there are a lot of, when I had those huge transcripts, I spent lunch hours in, and if I could only get five pages done on a lunch hour, you know, whatever I could do, any free time that I had there, I would take advantage of it because it was a huge page count to get out. So I know that I worked all my lunch hours. I just brought my lunch and worked at my desk. So over my lunch hour, I would work on it at my desk. There were many days where I just stayed late and worked for a while at the office because that was a quieter place than my home. I have three kids. It's work that's done outside of the workplace, except if I have a lunch hour that I can use the time for, I will. But out of the 8 to 5 hours.
Representative Rush.
Thank you. And the reason I ask is just because I know, I'm sure the judges are very aware of this as well. And when you work for a judge, sometimes the judge is probably going to let that slide knowing that you're not getting paid for it under the current structure. So I just want to know if the structure would change, if the habits would change. So that's all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, I would just renew my motion and that we lay the bill over.
The bill will be laid over for inclusion in the omnibus. Possible inclusion.
You were safe the first time.
Representative Liebling, we have House File 1049.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling, I understand that the motion will be that that House File 1049 would be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee with the recommendation that it be re-referred to Transportation Finance because they have control over this particular account.
That's my understanding too, Mr. Chair. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, with that, I would move House File 1049 that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee, as you stated, with recommendation that it go to Transportation Finance.
Welcome, Representative Liebling. You want to present your bill?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, members, this is an agency bill from the Office of Pipeline Safety, and a very simple bill. It just simply raises the maximum penalties for pipeline safety violations. And with me today is the State Fire Marshal, Jerry Rosendahl, and I'm going to let him explain the bill, and I'll turn it over to him. Thank you.
Mr. Rosendahl, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Jerry Rosendahl, State Fire Marshal and Director of Pipeline Safety. This bill basically makes the penalties in our state law equal to those in federal law, and that is important because we will be audited by the Federal Pipeline and Hazardous Material Safety Agency on a contract that we have with them to inspect all interstate pipelines in Minnesota. They do an audit on our program, and one of the items that they formerly referred to or noticed to us but did not penalize us for in this audit was the penalty fees being the same as the federal government. The federal government has raised the penalty limits to the limits you see in this bill. They've raised the limits three times in the last 20 years. The Office of Pipeline Safety in Minnesota was established 20 years ago by the legislature. So now they're going to start penalizing us, which means we could lose a point on our audit, which equates to dollars that they would not give us, because if we get maximum points, they provide up to 50% of the funding of our office. So that equates to dollars that we would not receive on the federal contract. And the remaining amount of money is provided through the Special Revenue Fund through fees that we then impose on the utilities that we regulate based on the number of miles of pipeline and the number of meters on their system. So it impacts Minnesota utilities or utilities that are located in Minnesota. And I would just offer that the preferred method of gaining compliance towards public safety is education and working with the utility companies. I believe we have a very good working relationship with them, and penalties are used as a point of last resort, really. So I'd be able to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, or to the Fire Marshal, these are steep increases here, and I guess I hear what you're saying about the federal audit. My question, though, is if someone is found to have violated one of the rules, are they subject to penalties under Minnesota law and federal law? So are we talking about a $200,000 penalty or a $2 million penalty? Or talk to me about that.
Mr. Rosendahl.
Mr. Chair and members, is either we are the ones that are administering the penalty, there would not be any duplication. Just as a point of reference, over the last 5 years, the total amount of penalties that we've levied against utilities, these are numbers for each of these years, $76,000, $8,000, $46,000, $12,000, and $9,000. So this is not, again, I emphasize my point, I guess, is that we work on education and working with the companies. That's a total amount we've levied on all utilities.
Mr. Chair, the penalty then is discretionary to the commissioner in terms of the amount, right? We're not talking about a $100,000 penalty every time. It could be $5,000 if it's just negligence or something like that that's immediately corrected.
Mr. Rosendahl.
Mr. Chair and members, that is absolutely correct. I should have explained that there is a scale and a number of criteria that we use in our office. The inspectors review it, our chief engineer reviews it, and we have discretion up to. These are the maximum allowed, and that's all we have to. We need to get put into the law is the maximum allowed to conform to the federal penalty.
Is there, are there any other questions for the fire marshal? Is there anyone else who, do you have any other witnesses, Representative Liebling, or is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify in support or in opposition to this bill? Okay. Then Representative Liebling renews her motion to that House File 1049 pass and be referred to the Finance Committee with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Thank you, Mr. Rosendahl. Is there any other business before the committee? If not, meeting's adjourned.